Once again, we had to jump to a more advanced position. Some men were shouting to give themselves courage. Others, like me, ground their teeth, and clenched their sweaty hands on their guns, less from emotion than from a reflex akin to that of a drowning man hanging onto a rope. Accompanied by deep or shrill sounds, and brilliant or fading light, the earth flew up all around us, sometimes engulfing pathetic human figures dressed as soldiers. About 30 yards away, on our left, 5 of our men who had hidden behind a small wooden building, like a blacksmith's shed, fell, one after the other. The last 2 had no idea where to run, and looked frantically for the enemy who would presently knock them off too. Finally, they threw themselves down among the bodies of their companions. A thick stream of blood ran out from the tangled mass of limbs and trunks and sank into the grey dust, which absorbed it like blotting paper. Suddenly, to our left, a raging fire broke out in a cluster of 4 or 5 sheds. Its smoke and heat climbed into the sky, and a huge sheet of flame quivered and grew with astounding speed, giving off giant wreaths of black smoke and intense heat, which we could feel even where we were. Our men surged back rapidly from that quarter. The metal roofs of the sheds buckled in the heat, and the isthmus closest to the fire burst into flame. A horde of Russians, both civilian and military, ran from the burning buildings. Our soldiers shot them down like rabbits. One of our shells must have hit a gasoline dump. The resulting inferno routed the panic-stricken enemy, who paid dearly for having concentrated so many men beside such a volcano. Their men rushed through the confusion with their hands in the air, occasionally remembering the way to other Russian entrenchments. Our packs were now concentrating their fire on the area immediately surrounding the factory, and the job of cleaning up the people running from the gasoline dump was left to us. The foresight of my gun often disappeared in a swiftly moving Russian silhouette. A light pressure on the trigger, a puff of smoke, which for an instant veiled the end of my weapon, and my Mauser looked for another victim. Will I be forgiven? Was I responsible? That young muzik, already wounded several times, more bewildered than anything else by the lethal uproar whose purpose was as obscure to him as it was to me, who stayed in my sights a moment too long and then turned ashen and clutched his breast with both hands before making a half turn and falling face down onto the ground. Shall I ever deserve pardon for that? Can I ever forget? But the almost drunken exhilaration which follows fear induces the most innocent youths on whatever side to commit inconceivable atrocities. Suddenly, for us, as it had been for Ivan a moment before, everything that moved through the din and the smoke became hateful, and overwhelmed us with a desire for destruction, a desire which led many soldiers to their deaths as they pursued the panic-stricken enemy. Our big guns pulverized the top end of the village, where the Russian artillery had dug in. In the general flight, the few wretched hovels which had not been burned fell, one by one, into our young, criminal hands. We ran full speed over ground which might have been mined. Nothing could stop us. Nothing stopped my good friend Hals from jumping across a stable threshold and shooting the Russian gunners who were desperately trying to fire their jammed weapon. Nothing could stop the glorious 8th and 14th companies of German infantry. As the communique tilde copyright s later observed, with an irresistible thrust, our valiant troops retook the town of X this morning. Nothing could stop our demoniac assault, not even the rending cries of Obajfra to War Ortenbik, who clenched his trembling hands on an iron grill and stiffened himself against the death which flooded from the bloody pulp which had once held his entrails. A few more of our comrades were destroyed before we reached the factory. At that point, the packs stopped firing to spare our own troops, who were right beside the Soviet defenders. The Russians clung stubbornly to what they still had, particularly to the sector immediately around the factory. I no longer remember exactly what happened. My group joined the veteran and his men, who were snatching a few moments of rest in a large cement settling tank. We all emptied our water bottles without quenching our thirst. Everyone was covered with dust. A telephone operator settled down beside us, and spoke with Group Commandant Wezridov. The fighting had died down somewhat, and the German troops were regrouping for the final assault. The veterans section had a mortar as well as its two FMSOs consisted of grenadiers armed with machine guns and rifles. Our sergeant placed us down the length of the cistern, specifying the points we should try to reach once the attack had started. We agreed to do as he asked before there was time for our terror to grow uncontrollable. These moments of waiting were often the hardest of all. A group of Russians suddenly appeared, climbing through some dismantled scaffolding near the factory, waving a white cloth. There must have been at least 60 of them, all civilians, probably factory workers. Maybe they were partisans, and afraid of execution. They walked up to the veterans' men, and turned themselves in. The anxiety stamped across every man's face lent great pathos to the moment. The veteran, who was fluent in Russian, talked to them. Protected by the white cloth, four of our men took the prisoners to the rear. It was one of those odd moments of calm, when it almost seemed as if a few friendly words between the adversaries might produce a settlement which would have allowed all of us to sit down and have a drink. But in the madness of our existence, the most simple things eluded us. Everyone was absorbed by immediate necessities. Most of us never even thought of the symbolic value of the steps those men had just taken, first steps back to the essentials of life. Even the exceptions to this general insensibility kept their wild eyes glued to the metallic wreckage of the factory, which we would soon be obliged to attack and enter. Animals, which have a stronger instinctive sense than human beings, turn and run from a fire. But we, the elect among living creatures, press forward, like moths to a candle. That is what we call courage, a quality I lack. Fear knotted my throat, and I felt like a sheep at the threshold of the slaughterhouse. I'm sure I wasn't the only one who had this feeling. The fellow beside me stared at me for a moment from his blackened face and murmured, "If only those bastards would give up." But our feelings, of course, were unimportant. The trench telephone rang and crackled out an order, 1/3 of the men forward. Count off by threes. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Like a miracle from heaven, I drew a 1, and could stay in that splendid cement hole, which at that moment seemed to me as magnificent as any palace. It was a secure refuge in which I would have spent my days in gratitude so long as death was stalking outside. I cut off or smile, in case the sergeant should notice and send me on to the field, but inwardly thanked God, and Allah, and Buddha, and heaven, earth, water, fire, trees, anything I could think of, that I was in that cement depression, which had held God knows what kind of filth before it sheltered me. The fellow beside me had number 3. He was looking at me, with a long, desperate face, but I kept my eyes turned front, so he wouldn't notice my joy and relief, and stared at the factory as if it were I who was going to leap forward, as if I were number 3. But, in fact, everything was normal. Dry was my neighbor, he was going to inspect the factory. Then the sergeant made his fatal gesture, and the brave German soldier beside me sprang from his shelter with 100 others. Immediately, we heard the sound of Russian automatic weapons. Before vanishing to the bottom of my hole, I saw the impact of the bullets raising little fountains of dust all along the route of my recent companion, who would never again contemplate the implications of number 3. The noise of guns and grenades was deafening and almost drowned the cries of the fellows who'd been hit. Achtung! Numbers Y, Vroz. The veteran and his Spandau ran up in turn. Next, it was going to be me, along with everybody else who'd counted 1. While everything outside was flashing and exploding, I thought for a moment about numbers. Usually, people begin counting with 1. Why had they started with 3 this time? But I could only pose the question. Before there was time to consider it, my turn had come. Number 1's, Nachgen, Loss. After a moment of hesitation, I sprang from my shelter like a jack-in-the-box, into madness. Everything looked grey, through a thick fog of whirling, choking dust, except for the glimmering flashes of light. In a few jumps I had reached the foundation of a shattered hut where a German soldier had died staring at the open breech of his machine gun. It's strange how often human beings die without any kind of style. 2 years before, I had seen a woman run over by a milk truck, and had nearly fainted at the sight of her mangled body. Now, after 2 years in Russia, visible death meant nothing at all, and the tragic element of even the best murder novels seemed petty and frivolous. With my watering eyes, I stared through the smoke, trying to see the enemy and do my duty. About 25 yards away, some trucks exploded into little fragments, one after the other, engulfing 4 or 5 running soldiers. Were the men German or Russian? I couldn't tell. I was with 2 companions in an open shelter made of logs packed with dirt, which the Russians had built to take a machine gun. We were more or less sitting on the mangled bodies of the 4 Popovs who'd been killed by grenades. "I did that bunch in, with one shot," shouted a strong young soldier from the Gross Deutschland. A burst of mortar fire forced us down into the heap of enemy corpses. A shell hit the edge of the bunker, and the earth and logs blew apart, falling back onto our heads. The fellow huddled between me and a dead Russian was hit. As his body jerked up from the impact, I tensed myself to run. Another shell struck the shelter, disintegrating it. The debris poured down onto my legs and sent me reeling back against the opposite wall. I howled for help, sure that my legs were broken, and afraid to move. My trousers were ripped down the leg, but the bruised skin underneath was unbroken, although I could trace the red-violet passage of the blow I'd taken. I plunged back into the heap of Russian corpses, falling onto the fellow who'd been hit a moment before. He let out a howl. We lay side by side, with our heads touching, as an avalanche of rubble poured down all around us. "I'm wounded," he groaned. "Something is burning in my back. Call for a stretcher." I looked at him, and dazedly shouted, "Sanfantrigger." But my ludicrous cries were lost in the deafening uproar of 2 Spandors firing quite near us. The big fellow from the Gross Deutschland was shouting at us to advance, as loud as he could, "Come on, fellows. Some of our boys are already at the water tank." I looked at the wounded man, who was staring at me with desperate, imploring eyes and clutching my sleeve. I didn't know how to tell him that there was nothing I could do for him just then. The big soldier had jumped out of the shelter. I pulled myself brutally away, and turned my head. The wounded man called again, but I had already jumped from the shelter and was running like a madman after the other fellow, who was nearly 15 yards ahead of me. I joined another group who were hurriedly setting up 2 trench mortars, and helped them maneuver the tubes into position. Instantly, our mortar bombs were shooting almost straight up. A lancer, whose face was pouring blood, shouted that the Russians had withdrawn to the central tower. The veteran, whom I hadn't noticed before, let out a savage howl. "Got him." As he shouted, a white flash lit his face, which was covered with an incredible layer of dust, and a geyser of flame enveloped the tower. The Russian defense crumbled and fell under the impact of our concentrated fire. Our assault groups moved in and cleaned up the last resistance. Another German soldier fell, clutching his face, and then it was all over, except for a few widely scattered shots. I and my companions ran into the ruins of what had once been a factory but was now reduced to rubble beyond classification. Once again, we were victorious, but the victory gave us no joy. Stupefied by the noise and the nervous tension, we wandered among the twisted, collapsed metal roofs. A lancer with a face drawn by exhaustion mechanically picked up an enamel plaque which had something written on it in Cyrillic characters, perhaps a direction, or the word for toilet. The town had fallen to us. There were about 300 prisoners, in addition to 200 enemy dead or wounded. The non-coms regrouped us, and led us back through the smoking devastation of the village. Herr Hauptmann Wesredau reviewed his 2 companies, and called roll. About 60 men were missing. We collected the wounded, and regrouped them to wait for our 3 orderlies to give them first aid. There were about 15 wounded men, including Holen Greyer, whose right eye was gone. Finding water was difficult. The Priekas had been smashed, and we finally had to lower soup kettles down a well in the ashes of one of the izbas. The water was black with soot. The wounded were screaming with pain, most of them were delirious. There were also about 75 Russian wounded, who presented a dilemma to our commandant. In principle, we should have helped them too, as best we could. But we were under orders to rejoin our division as soon as the operation was completed. So we abandoned the Russian wounded, and piled ours into and onto the vehicles we had, which bore no resemblance to ambulances, or even to ordinary trucks, a few gun carriages and a couple of light artillery tractors. We felt exhausted, disgusted, and numb. There was also the question of how to move the prisoners. There was no room in our collection of already overloaded vehicles. Finally, a sidecar fitted with an FM slowly drove some 50 of the prisoners along ahead of it. We turned them loose 2 days later, for lack of anything better to do with them. As an autonomous group, we were faced with extremely difficult problems of supply. In theory, the vehicles carrying munitions and gasoline picked up the flotsam of war as their loads grew lighter. But the division already had some 1,100 prisoners, and we didn't know what to do with them. We set off with clusters of men, German and Russian, hanging on to everything that could roll. We all looked back at the town, from which a thick cloud of smoke was climbing, and spreading out to the horizon. The dark grey sky was threatening rain, which would soon fall on the graves of 40 German soldiers sacrificed to neutralize a single point of enemy resistance, which we weren't even interested in holding. We moved on to another operation, not as part of any design to conquer, but simply as part of an attempt to protect our vast withdrawal of troops to the west bank of the Dnieper. No one smiled. We knew that our victory couldn't make any difference to the outcome of the war, and only hoped that it might have some strategic interest. The experience of the battle itself had been, as always, more fear and, for some, like my friend Greyer, irreparable mutilation. A young blonde soldier, huddled beside the driver of the machine which was carrying about 30 of us, began to play on his harmonica. The melody rang softly in our nearly insensible ears. "Mit Eder, Lily Marlene, Mit Eder, Lily Marlene." The music was slow and filled with a nostalgia which weighed heavily on our exhaustion. Hals was listening, his mouth hanging half open, making no sound, and staring at nothing. The breakthrough at Konotop, we drove for an hour, which meant about 30 miles before it grew dark. We were all anxious to stop so that we could get rid of the thick, choking dust which coated us from head to foot. We were also exhausted and longing for sleep. Although a good bed in a warm barracks would have been paradise, any place where we could have stretched out and lost consciousness would have done. And we knew that when we did stop we would collapse onto the ground, and sink immediately into blackness. The dark sky was filled with heavy black clouds lit up on their outer fringes. Large drops of rain began to fall as the storm broke. The rain, so often a curse, seemed like a blessing this time, washing off the filthy faces we turned up to meet it. It soon became a downpour, running down our collars and over our bodies, like a gift from Providence to friend and foe alike, making us all smile with a sense, however partial, of returning well-being. The soaking cloth of the uniforms on our tightly packed bodies clung to all of us: grey-green for the Germans, violet-brown for the Russians. We all grinned at each other without distinction, like players from two teams in the showers after a match. There was no longer any feeling of hatred or vengeance, only a sense of life preserved and overwhelming exhaustion. The rain became so heavy that we had to improvise shelter, and covered our heads and shoulders with our ground sheets. Although hardly anyone understood more than a few words of the other language, we were all laughing and trading cigarettes, Hanover cigarettes for Macaulay tobacco from the Tatar plain. We smoked and joked over nothing, a nothing which in fact represented the most absolute human joy I had ever known. The exchange of tobacco, the smoke under the ground sheet, which made us choke and cough, and the simple fact of laughter without reserve, all of this made a small island of joy in a sea of tragedy, which affected us like a shot of morphine. We were able to forget the hate which divided us, as our stupefied senses reawakened to an awareness of life. Understanding nothing, I laughed uncontrollably, as a curious sensation took hold of me and filled my veins. Suddenly I was covered with goose flesh, as one is during a particularly moving piece of music. The rain was beating on the metal hood. Would we have to shoot our Russian fellow passengers tomorrow? That seemed impossible. It was impossible that such things could continue. We had just caught up with a regiment of motorized cavalry, stopped in the middle of nowhere. Streams of water were running down every exposed surface, the dull finish of the sidecars sheltering under the dripping leaves of the trees at the edge of the woods glistened with raindrops. Wesreda climbed down from his sidecar to talk to the cavalry commander. The fellows in the sidecars had long oilskins which pretty well covered them, and kept them more or less dry. However, all their camping equipment was in the trucks of the supperly column, so instead of sleeping they had to spend their rest period tramping up and down through the puddles. Two fellows distributed food, a stale sausage for each German soldier and loaves of bread to be divided among eight. There was no food for the prisoners, whose rations, in theory, would be provided by the division. We thought of walking off a short way to devour our meager portions, but we were bunched around our dripping communal plates. The Russians, who had nothing but their lives, kept their feverish eyes fixed on the food, which was impossible to hide. Finally, our torn and filthy hands broke the hard bread and held it out to the men who had been trying to kill us only a few hours before. Our stomachs were still rumbling with hunger 5 minutes later, as we swallowed down the last mouthfuls of our rations. Everyone was thirsty, and our water bottles had been emptied after the fighting. Like feverish sheep, we needed water. We had obtained permission to leave the trucks to relieve ourselves, but for no other reason. We were in the middle of wild, uninhabited country, and there were no priekas or drinking troughs. However, the rain was still pouring down, and we collected the runoff from the backs of the trucks, and the leaves, and the puddles in the oilcloths. When we had quenched our thirst, we left with the cavalry regiment. Finally, the rain stopped, leaving us chilled and bone-tired, to the misery of our throbbing machines. Lightning was still streaking through the sky behind us and over our heads, and the thunder was still rumbling. Ahead, there were other flashes too, which unfortunately had nothing to do with the storm. These were produced by Stalin's organs, firing at the division blocked behind Konotop. As we drew nearer, we were able to gauge the size of the battle by the intensity of the fire flashing across the horizon. Soon we also could hear the loud and continuous sound of guns. We had been hoping for a refuge where we could spend the night. Instead, we were faced with the anguish of a fresh hell, and a fresh uncertainty of survival, as war tightened its vise-like grip once again around our throbbing temples. The young face of the blonde boy who had played the harmonica a short time before hardened suddenly into the face of a man. Was it exhaustion, or did he simply want to get it over with? In the space of a few moments, he suddenly aged 20 years. We arrived at the town, which was black and deserted. Intermittent flashes from the battle being fought somewhere to the west of us, through the outer fringes of the town, lit the darkness. The thunder of explosions filled the air, shattering window panes and breaking off the gutters of the houses all around us. The rain had begun again, falling in small, delicate drops. We were ordered to leave the trucks, and jumped down like sleepwalkers. The shock of contact with the ground reverberated through our numbed bodies, and we felt sickness rising in undulating waves, along the entire length of our spinal columns. In a herd, we followed our leaders, while the trucks drove off to a nearby street. I could feel the sleep weighing down my eyelids, and, only half awake, staggered like an automaton after the sound of the boots of the fellow in front of me, without grasping that I was going back into battle. What happened that night at Konotop? I only know that there were explosions and fire and houses collapsing down the length of dark, indefinable back streets. There was a gutter full of running water, and there were my hard, heavy boots, which I scarcely had the strength to lift, and my big bony feet inside them, which felt as if they were growing smaller and smaller, and the heat of my throbbing temples, which had begun to burn with fever, and the crushing fatigue which had settled around my thin shoulders, trapped in the filth of my undershirt and waterlogged tunic, and the tangle of leather straps and cartridge belts, heavy with ammunition, and the incomprehensible, hostile world, whose weight we still had to bear, where we still had to march and crawl and tremble. Toward morning, which dawned as pale as the last morning of a condemned man, I was overwhelmed by a crushing sleep, and briefly lost my waking nightmare. We collapsed in the shelter of an entranceway, which protected us from most of the rain, except when the wind blew a particularly strong gust. We spent a few hours there, then we were wakened, to stare at 100 other faces as white and drawn as our own. Our closest relatives would probably have hesitated before identifying us. My eyes, which felt as if they had sunk into my aching head, instinctively looked around to see what the new day would bring. Directly in front of the gate where we had slept was a building of several stories. Its grey walls were stained with long streaks which dribbled down from its gaping windows. A short distance to one side stood a cluster of miserable shacks which now offered shelter only to a few wandering cats, and troops looking for refuge. These buildings, which at their best could never have looked like much, now seemed soiled by the passage of something monstrous. Further along, the street was entirely blocked by the houses which had collapsed when the Russians had shelled the town the evening before. I looked for something which might produce an instant of pleasure, and distract me for a moment from the effort of trying to control the spasmodic shivers which shook my whole body. A sound behind me made me turn my head. The veteran was coming back with two canteens of hot soup, which he had found God knows where. I watched him blankly as he limped through the puddles and the scattered rubble. His uniform was as grey and filthy as the setting, and his thin, shaggy face beneath his heavy steel helmet seemed to fit perfectly with everything else. Above our heads, the sky flowed slowly toward the horizon, trailing grey clouds, like dirty rags, as far as the eye could see. "Anyone who wants to eat better open his eyes," the veteran called, putting down the canteens. I quickly shook Hal's, whose sleep, as always, seemed impenetrable. He jumped, but when he realized it wasn't a new bombardment or attack he pulled himself together, muttering a few incomprehensible words, and finally stood up, rubbing his stiff and aching body. "God, I'm sick of this," he said, in a disgusted, weary voice. "Where are we, and what the hell are we doing here?" "Come and eat," said the veteran. In silence, we devoured the militant soup, which was already beginning to cool. Some of the fellows preferred to sleep a little longer. Then we were ordered out again, and began to walk slowly through the devastated sector of Konotop. We were too exhausted to notice much, and walked without thinking or looking. When we were forced to recognize an explosion or an airplane, we slid to the ground without haste. Then we got up again. And so on. I was certainly ill. My head and back ached, probably from exhaustion, and I was shaking with the cold shivers of fever. But there was nothing to do about it. If I felt any worse later, I would try to get sent to a hospital, but, for that, I would have to faint. We reached a section of the town that had suffered particularly heavy damage. In the ruins, we could see an enormous tiger tank, which had plowed a large furrow through the heaps of rubble and appeared to have been stopped by a mine, which had blown off its right dread. Despite this, it was otherwise intact, and its gun was still spitting occasional shells at the enemy formations, which were very close. Groups of soldiers hiding in the ruins seemed to be waiting for Ivan, who must have been digging in nearby. We moved carefully through the rubble to a hole where Hal's and I settled down. For at least a half mile ahead of us, and 500 yards behind us, we could see nothing but wreckage. Groaning with the effort, we piled up all the solid pieces of rubble we could move, to keep ourselves off the bottom of the hole, which was covered with blackish water. We stared at each other in a kind of stupefied silence. We had already said everything there was to say under the circumstances. Our lives at that moment were reduced to waiting. The force of events had already inflicted enough horror to drive us mad. "You really look filthy," Hal said finally. "I'm sick," I said. We're all sick, Hals answered, his eyes fixed on our universe of destruction. Our exhausted eyes met for a moment, and I saw on my friend's face an almost limitless depth of weariness and despair.